From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, an Iranian journalist shares the story of his incarceration and his work on behalf of other imprisoned journalists.
Later, a writer had long wanted to share the sobering story of an old acquaintance who went to work for Foxconn in China.
I just wanted to essentially honor his memory, having no idea that the place where he met his demise is going to move to my home state. It was a very odd cosmic coincidence.
Plus, economies around the world continue to expand, but are there question marks on the horizon?
One of the first questions we have is that, will the global expansion be a victim of its own success?
And a Milwaukee researcher works to understand why the odds of dying from breast cancer vary greatly based on race and ethnicity. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. When journalist Mazyar Bahari went to his home country of Iran in 2009, he had no idea what was in store for him. As protests mounted in opposition to the re-election of then-President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Bahari was imprisoned by the Iranian government simply for doing his job.
An international campaign led to his release more than 100 days later, and his story was immortalized in his memoir, Then They Came For Me, and the Jon Stewart film, Rosewater. But long before his fateful trip to Iran, he was known for something else.
Bahari is thought to be the first Muslim to make a film about the Holocaust called The Voyage of the St. Louis. He was in town to give a speech at the Nathan and Esther Peltz Holocaust Education Resource Center. But first, he joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio, and he starts by talking about his distinction.
I didn't want to be the first. I was passionate about the issue of immigration and the Holocaust when I was at university in Montreal. That was a long time ago, in 1993. And I wanted to make a film that could bring both issues together. And when I researched, I came across the story of the Voyage of the St. Louis, which was a ship of Jewish immigrants in 1939 that had more than 900 German Jewish refugees who had temporary visas to go to Cuba and then come to the U.S. or go to Canada. But then their visas were annulled, and then they had to go back to Europe, and many of them died during the Holocaust. So actually, that brought me to Milwaukee for the first time in my life as well in 1993, and I met a wonderful man named Phil Freund, who unfortunately passed away last year. And we brought together a group of survivors, and we made a film called The Voyage of the St. Louis, which was shown on Discovery Channel, I think, in this country.
You said, of course, that you didn't want to be the first. I think that there's this natural perception that if you're Muslim, somehow maybe you're not anti-Jewish, but you might have some anti-Semitic feelings. Was there any of that?
Well, actually, that was one of the reasons that I was motivated to make that film, because whenever I was going to interview the survivors or their families or even doing research in different places, they were asking me why you're interested, why you're even interested. And, you know, my answer was that why not? Because so many Christian, Jewish, and people from other religions have made films about other subjects. And why not a Muslim or someone who is technically Muslim should make a film about Jews? You know, it was a human story and it was a human rights story, and I had to do it. So I think I made that film because I wanted to prove that there are other kind of Iranians, there are other kind of Muslims as well who empathize with the plight of other people. And there are not only people who are anti-Semitic in Iran, you know. And the fact that Iranian people are very different from the government.
Well, kind of on the point of the government and this film, it's something that ended up kind of coming back to haunt you in a way.
Exactly. So, as we say in films, cut. 15 years after I made the film, in 1994, and I was arrested in Iran for being a journalist in 2009 during the Green Movement in Iran after the re-election of Ahmadinejad as president. And one of the questions, one of the accusations against me was that I was a spy for the CIA, for the Israeli Mossad. And as one of the proof that they, evidence that they wanted to say that I was an Israeli agent was the fact that I made a film about the Holocaust. Because to many Iranian officials, and especially to many Revolutionary Guards, the people who arrested me, a good Jew is only a dead Jew. And for them, anyone sympathizing with the Holocaust or with the Jewish people is a spy. And it was interesting that the Revolutionary Guards, they did not really have a perception of Jews as real people or as Israel as people, as a country. They thought of them as elements, as just a concept, as enemy. So when they asked me, for example, they wanted me to give them the name of all the Jewish elements that I've met in my life. And when I asked them, what do you mean by elements? You mean Jewish people? The person said that just name the most vicious, the most devious people you've ever met in your life, and they're all definitely Jews. So it was... I was in prison for 118 days, 107 days in solitary confinement, and I didn't have access to any books or, you know, any information. And I always say that my incarceration really did not broaden my knowledge, but deepened my knowledge of the Revolutionary Guards, of their paranoia, especially the way they think about the world. And especially the way they think about Israel and Jewish people.
Now, to just take a step back, I know you were in Iran for the election, but how did you end up in prison?
Well, the Iranian government has a pattern of behavior that they arrest people, they concoct the scenario, and through that scenario, they want to either scare a group of people, larger group of people, or they want to get rid of part of the faction within the Iranian government. And I was the unlucky person, I guess, who was chosen, that through my arrest, they wanted to scare off other journalists and filmmakers in Iran because I was somehow prominent at the time. And also, they wanted me to confess or like lie that I had put some people within the Iranian government, the reformists within the Iranian government, in touch with foreign governments. And through that, they wanted to incriminate them. That was the main reason for my arrest. And during the 118 days that I was in prison, I was not really asked about what I did. But I was being beaten and tortured both physically and psychologically to confess to what they wanted me to say. That, yes, I had put so-and-so in touch with the British embassy, for example, or with an American government official.
In some ways, you kind of responded to your imprisonment with this organization. Our future society will be a free society.
That is the motto of the organization. Our campaign is called Journalism is Not a Crime.
Okay.
Yes. Journalism is Not a Crime is a campaign for the right of journalists all around the world. And as you know, journalism is becoming a very dangerous profession these days. And that campaign, that motto for the campaign that we had with Committee to Protect Journalists was the start of our campaign to basically bring names and stories to journalists who are incarcerated in Iran, but also all around the world. Because the reason that I'm here talking to you is the result of a campaign. I had an amazing campaign launched by my employer at the time, Newsweek magazine, which was owned by Washington Post and many of my colleagues around the world. But many Iranian journalists and journalists in other countries, they're not as lucky as I am. They do not have anyone to campaign for them. So as a result, they're reduced to statistics, numbers. When you hear that 57 journalists are arrested in Turkey, for example, or 37 arrested in Russia or China or Iran, these are not only numbers. These are human beings with families, with stories, with loved ones. And what we're trying to do through our campaign, Journalism is Not a Crime, is to give faces, names to these numbers, faces to these names, and tell the stories of these people in order to humanize them and in order to make people to understand their stories. I think some journalists, many journalists, they are heroes of our time. When you think about the effect that the journalism really has had, the positive effect that journalism has had on our societies all around the world, and how journalism has made societies a better society by making people in power more accountable, you can see the risks that journalists are taking. And as a result, many people in power, as you know, in this country, of course, have made journalists number one enemies.
Speaking of number one enemies, when you hear President Trump, or really many people in the Republican Party right now, calling out journalists, calling them the enemy of the people, what does that make you think?
Well, you know, the Nazis called journalists enemies of people, and they called the newspapers and the media they didn't like fake news. I'll let you come to a conclusion to what I think about other people who are doing the same thing, you know, six decades later.
With the rise of this kind of anti-media sentiment, there's also been a rise in anti-Semitism in this country. Do you think that in some ways the two are connected?
Definitely. I think bigotry begets bigotry, and ignorance promotes ignorance. So if you're a bigoted person and you have prejudice against Jews, you will not stop at being an anti-Semite. You are also anti-gays, anti-Muslims, anti-immigrants, anti-people who want to inform you about other people who are, i.e. journalists. So you're anti-journalism as well. And we saw the embodiment of this kind of people. We saw the examples in Charlottesville a few months ago. The people who paraded in Charlottesville and said that Jews will not replace us, these are the people who are anti-black, they're anti-gay, they're anti-Muslim, they're anti-immigrant. And unfortunately, I think many politicians, they try to use these bigoted movements, these, let's say, ignorant people. At best, they are ignorant. At worst, they are really malicious actors. But at best, let's say they're ignorant. But some politicians, they try to exploit these ignorant people in order to further their own policies, not knowing that in the long term, they are going to become liabilities. They're not going to become allies. So that's why I think as people in the media, people in who work in human rights organizations, we have to promote tolerance and we have to fight bigotry in any form of and shape. Because you cannot say that I'm someone who is for the rights of the Muslims and immigrants and then have anti-Semitic attitudes. It's not possible. Or you cannot say that, you know, I'm for the rights of Jewish people and Muslims and then be against homosexuals, because that is counterproductive, basically.
So you have another film coming out, 82 Names. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. The film is about Mansour Omari, who is a human rights, Syrian human rights activist who was in jail in Syria for almost a year. And he brought out five pieces of fabric with 82 names of them. And this is a very courageous act. And he's going to be celebrated in the Holocaust Museum in Washington with an exhibition And why is it so courageous of Mansour to do that? It's because the Syrian government, like any other authoritarian regimes, they are trying to suppress information. And any information related to prisoners in Syria, it can cause the person who is registering or documenting that information to death. And Mansour basically could be executed for writing those names. And when I hear the stories that Mansour talks about Syrian prisons, it's unbelievable. And the fact that Holocaust Museum is organizing an exhibition for Mansour Omari, who is a Syrian human rights activist in the 21st century, is very telling as well. Of course, it is not exactly the same what happened in the Holocaust or what happened in Rwanda or what happened in Cambodia, but it is a crime against humanity. What the Assad regime is doing with somehow impunity is very similar to what many modern-day monsters had done in the 21st century. And the film is basically grew out of my own frustration and anger that why we are seeing this happening over and over again. After the Holocaust, during the Second World War, we said never again. Then we had Cambodia. Then we had Rwanda. And now we are seeing hundreds of thousands of people are being killed by the Assad regime with chemical weapons. It's just unbelievable. So the film is really an attempt to find out an answer for this anger and confusion.
Journalist Maziar Bahari is the author of Then They Came For Me, a memoir that recounts his time as a prisoner of the Iranian government and the inspiration for the film Rosewater by Jon Stewart.
Bahari is also the first Muslim to create a film about the Holocaust, The Voyage of the St. Louis. He's currently working on 82 Names, a film that recounts the experiences of Syrian journalist Mansour Omari, who risked his life by smuggling a list of detainee names out of a notorious Syrian prison.
Coming up next, a Milwaukee writer shares the sobering story of a young man he knew in China who went to work at a Foxconn factory. That's coming up after a break as Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. This Friday, Lake Effect will air a one-hour special about the proposed Foxconn factory in Racine County, recorded on-site at the Prairie School in Wynn Point. Our Across the Divide broadcast, produced in association with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, examines questions about the project as it moves forward.
There are not a lot of people in the area with direct experience with a Taiwanese company, but Milwaukee writer Dan Simmons has some indirect experience, having taught someone who went to work for Foxconn in China. Simmons shared the experience in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. He'll read that essay in a moment, but first he explained why he was moved to write it.
I've been wanting to write it for a long time since it was such a dramatic event in my life. This student of mine, Brad, left a real impression on me, and then he met a very unfortunate end. And I just wanted to essentially honor his memory, tell a story. Having no idea that 7 years later or whatever it is, all of a sudden the place where he met his demise is going to move to my home state. It was a very odd cosmic coincidence.
Well, and when the news came that Foxconn would potentially build and open a factory in Wisconsin, that must have set off, I don't know, either alarm bells or certainly brought back this flood of memories.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of mixed emotions, to put it politely. I think a lot of outrage, just knowing, having lived in China and knowing what Foxconn's reputation is there, which is, you know, not strong at all. It just didn't, not in a million years would it occur to me that this is a company that would be really actively courted and invited with, you know, with trumpets blaring. So So yeah, it was just a puzzling development in history that, you know, connects to my own life.
Certainly adds some interesting context to the stories we're all hearing about the potential factory here.
Very much, yeah.
All right. Well, let's hear your essay.
Okay, so the title is Braveheart Boy. Among the hundreds of students I taught in a Chinese village, Brad stood out. He gave his final speech first semester singing Christmas carols to the voice of an origami frog. He acted alongside me and the three little pigs, he a pig, I the big bad wolf. The last time I saw him, he had given a final speech spring semester in the voice of William Wallace in Braveheart. His clarion call to freedom in his second language stirred his classmates to sustained applause, which was common for Brad. He stood maybe 5'5" and wore the same red flannel shirt, khakis, and easy smile every day. You couldn't help but like him. His real name was Fung, but I chose his English name in honor of another Brad, one of my best friends. In the Q&A after the Braveheart speech, a young woman asked the kind of absurd question that populates Chinese textbooks about the English language. If you were on a bridge and you saw a woman drowning and you jumped in to save her, would you consider yourself a hero? No, came Brad's immediate reply. It is every man's responsibility. The answer captured Brad's essence. So cheesy, and yet it came off as totally genuine. Everything he did carried the sweet scent of altruism, and his sunniness seemed real, a rarity in an authoritarian country where smiles can feel state-mandated. As I was leaving the village after a year there, I put, write a letter to Brad and tell him how awesome I think he is, on my to-do list. To my eternal regret, that letter never happened. The next I heard about him, I was back in the States 5 years after my time in the village. Nancy, a classmate of his, called me as I drove from Indianapolis to Chicago and asked if I remembered Braveheart Boy. She had news. He had jumped to his death from the 14th floor of his dormitory at a factory where he worked in the southern China boomtown of Shenzhen. A brief newspaper account said he left behind a handwritten note in his room, quote, too much pressure from work, really in a bad mood, end quote. Co-workers found him. He jumped at 8 a.m. That somber occasion introduced me to Foxconn, Brad's employer. His tragic death prompted many questions and thoughts about the company. One thought I didn't have, that Foxconn was destined to move to my home country, not grudgingly, but with welcome mats laid and politicians fawning, and that the state I'd eventually call home would open a Texas-sized vault of taxpayer money to lure it, relaxing building codes around waterways and shielding it from legal scrutiny and tax policies that homegrown businesses have to abide by, all for the grandiose but vague promises of job growth and economic development. Alas, here we are. In my disbelief, I came to learn that Foxconn is a Taiwanese company that makes most of the world's iPhones and other Apple products at city-sized factory complexes, mostly in mainland China. It neatly epitomizes China's supersonic growth rate of recent decades, in which products and millionaires get manufactured at a dizzying pace as the minions who toil making both feel forgotten. Brad was a cog in this global machine, and his story wasn't uncommon. In 2010, 18 Foxconn workers attempted suicide. 14 succeeded. It prompted Foxconn to order netting installed at its facilities to keep the employees alive. Following the suicide wave and some fatal factory explosions, came a wave of stories in the global media about the employment tactics of the company. Comparatively low wages, long hours, cramped living quarters, depressed workers. Foxconn, with a strong nudge from Apple, made changes in response and insisted everything was all good. The message was undercut in multiple ways, though, none more than when Foxconn's CEO compared his 1 million strong workforce to animals at a company event in 2012. While it's clearly made strides in recent years, most of the changes seem to come about not voluntarily but to save face, and words like progressive or employee-friendly do not ever spring to mind. So as my adopted American state prepares to take a big gamble and open its taxpayers' wallets into Foxconn's corporate kitty, I remain skeptical and think it's important to tell Brad's story. It is every man's responsibility.
Dan Simmons is a Milwaukee-based writer. His essay is in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Our Across the Divide special on Foxconn airs on Friday's show.
Another quick break and then a snapshot of the global economy as 2017 winds down. That story when Lake Effect continues right here on Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. For all of the political turmoil at home and in places like Germany, the UK, Zimbabwe, and the Middle East, the economic news at many levels has been generally positive in 2017. Economies in both developed and developing countries have expanded in the past 11 months.
But who is being left behind, and what does the forecast look like for the year ahead? Those are questions that Bill Adams looks at closely in his position as an economist specializing in non-U.S. economies for PNC Bank. He was in Milwaukee recently and joined us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was hoping we could start with maybe a sort of compare and contrast question. As you look at global economic conditions and try to look into the future, either the immediate future or down the road, what are the greatest certainties today, and what are giving you the most questions?
If you want to think of the global economy as having a report card, in 2016, we got some high marks in some parts of the world, and then in other parts of the world, we had some C's and D's. And what's striking about the economy today is that it's much more consistent. It's A's and B's economies across the world, very broad-based economic growth. Countries that had faced crisis or downturns are now back in expansion, along with countries that are doing well and some, like the United States, Eurozone, and Japan, even growing over trend.
Well, so what have been the factors that have led to this increased stability as you see it?
We're 8 years into a global economic expansion. Central banks have been unprecedented in the way they've supported growth with quantitative easing, negative interest rates, really unconventional economic policies. And after having those policies in place for years, that has brought financial markets around, and that has led an improvement in consumer spending and business spending, and finally now in hiring and wage growth as well.
So it'd be great if we could say the end, we're done, that's, you know, the world is in great hands and everybody's moving forward. But at the same time, first of all, economists wouldn't have a job to do. And secondly, this interview would end. But let me ask you, what are the greatest uncertainties that are still out there? What are the biggest question marks that still exist?
One of the first questions we have is that will the global expansion be a victim of its own success, which is to say, with the Fed likely to continue to raise interest rates next year, that's higher interest expense both for consumers, mortgage rates would go up a bit. Will that choke off the expansion? We don't think that that is going to end the U.S. expansion. We think the U.S. side still has legs. Higher interest rates also tend to create problems for emerging markets like China, Brazil, Mexico. But this time around, we think that because the Fed is raising interest rates gradually and is reacting to better growth prospects around the world and not just higher inflation. Inflation's still pretty low. It looks like we're still set for a solid expansion into next year.
There is currently work on the new version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership called, I believe, the CPTPP. The major difference is this new trade agreement is being done without the United States as a signee. Can you connect the dots for us? What is your best guess as to what the upshot of this agreement could be in terms of its impact both globally and then impact here at home?
Trade agreements like the CPTPP, I'm still learning how to say that, they tend to affect the global economy slowly and over time. Their effects are going to be felt over 10 or 20 years. So we're not altering our growth forecast for 2018 because of them. I think what this trade agreement illustrates is that even without the United States, these other Pacific economies believe that they have potential gains by working together and banding together into a trade bloc. This trade bloc will be about half the size of the U.S. economy, about equal in size to the Chinese economy. And so these smaller Pacific countries think that they can use a regional trade bloc as a way to counterbalance Chinese influence in the Pacific over the next decade.
And taken as a whole, these countries that are part of the CPTPP represent about half of the U.S. GDP. Is that right?
By my measure, it's a little over $10 trillion. So yes, a little over half of U.S. GDP. Depends on where the exchange rates sit in any given moment, but it's a considerable trade bloc. Biggest partners are Japan, Canada, Mexico, Australia.
And I gather, to some degree, the future of that agreement is linked to current renegotiations of the North American Free Trade Agreement, right?
We think that we're actually probably not going to see this new Pacific Trade Agreement come into effect until the NAFTA renegotiation ends. And that's because Mexico and Canada are in both agreements. They have to negotiate deals both facing the United States and facing their Pacific partners that are coherent and not set themselves up for creating problems for their industries selling into the two different trading blocks.
So now looking across the Atlantic, Brexit is moving along in a somewhat herky-jerky way, I guess is the maybe colloquial way to put it. What are your concerns about how that process is moving forward and what the ultimate impact of Brexit on the EU and global economies might be?
Herky-jerky Brexit is actually the technical term for this type of a trade negotiation.
Also a good band name.
So in terms of the effects of Brexit, so it's going to be until at least 2019 until there's any change in the UK's trade relations with the EU. Along the way, we're already seeing some businesses relocate from the UK to elsewhere in the EU, companies that were in the UK selling to customers in Germany or France, and concerned that they're going to lose the ability to do so as trading relations potentially change. It's actually not too late for the UK to go back and decide that they just want to stay in the EU after all. There are big downsides to either to negotiating a new trading arrangement with the EU where the UK would still have to give up quite a bit of control over its economy and over its immigration rules, or the UK could have to, if they want all of their own control, they would have to lose a lot of trade access to the EU. So it's still pretty open-ended what will happen. In terms of its impact on the global economy or even us back in the United States, I think the biggest effect is that the rest of Europe has watched the UK, watched its economy slow to be the slowest growing advanced economy in 2017 and said, I don't really want that for myself. And so a lot of the populist movements in Europe that looked like for example, in France, it seemed that like the populace could win a presidential election there in 2017, actually haven't come into power. And so the more centrist politics in Europe, I think, has kept political risk under control in 2017. It's one of the reasons why Europe grew so well in this past year.
They see the UK as a cautionary tale.
It's more fun to watch than to do yourself.
As we're having this conversation, President Trump has wrapped up his multi-country Asia visit. Did you see anything emerge from those visits that you see as indicative of things moving in any particular direction?
I thought it was noteworthy that there was a lot of focus on the $250 billion in business deals negotiated between U.S. and Chinese counterparts during President Trump's China visit. If you're cooperating, it means that you're not conflicting. And so I think to the extent that the U.S. is working towards cooperation with China, I think that makes a trade war less likely. I think a trade war would be lose-lose. So I think that is positive for the economic outlook. And then I think it's noteworthy that at the APEC, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, that was when the economic ministers of those 11 Asia-Pacific countries agreed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership modified deal, which shows that, you know, that was a U.S.-led deal, even with the U.S. not a participant anymore. It shows that the U.S., our role in the Asia-Pacific is still very significant.
The other major world event that I wanted to touch on, at least briefly, that's getting a fair amount of attention is what's going on in the Middle East. The prime minister of Lebanon sort of disappeared and then surfaced in Saudi Arabia and then resigned, but he's still in Saudi Arabia, but he's free to go at any time. And at the same time, there's this apparent purge in the royal governing family in Saudi Arabia. Is any of this likely to have an impact beyond the politics of the region into areas like oil prices, which have so much of an impact on everything else?
Oil prices, I think, are the first channel where we're going to see an effect in the United States of this Middle Eastern political risk on our economy. Since the arrest of members of the Saudi royal family. We've seen U.S. oil prices rise about 10%. And so that comes after Hurricanes Harvey and Irma pushed up gasoline prices for U.S. consumers. And it's another modest upward pressure on energy prices and inflation for consumers. On the other side, higher energy prices mean better business prospects for energy companies in the United States. In early November, we saw U.S. crude production reach a record high, highest it's ever been, on the weekly statistics. And I think the direction of U.S. Energy production is even higher from here.
Well, and with higher energy prices, does that sometimes come along with decreased demand? And with decreased demand come lower energy prices?
Directionally, we think that higher energy prices mean weaker demand over time, but we're starting from a pretty low level for gas prices in the United States. When I was a boy, oil was $100 a barrel, and since oil prices fell in 2014, the effective tax cut that gives to consumers who have more disposable income after filling their tanks, that's been a big boost to consumer spending. Even with slightly higher gas prices, I think that's not going to affect consumer spending in the near term.
Bill Adams, thanks so much for this snapshot.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bill Adams is an economist for PNC Bank, which is based in Pittsburgh. He was in Milwaukee last week, and we spoke with him then.
One last break, and then a Milwaukee researcher works to reduce disparities in the survival rate for breast cancer. She'll explain her work when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Breast cancer is the second leading cause of death for women in the United States. But your odds of dying from the disease vary greatly based on your race or ethnicity. African-American women in the United States are more likely to have aggressive forms of breast cancer and less likely to catch the disease in an early stage.
Dr. Alice Yan is hoping to change that. Yan is leading two separate research projects that seek to identify some of the causes of this disparity and how to fix them. Yan spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about her work.
Racial disparity is a major issue that exists, especially for breast cancer. For example, compared to the non-Hispanic white woman, Black women have a 41% higher breast cancer death rate, and also their 5-year survival rate is 23% lower than their white counterpart. So when we're talking about racial disparity, these are the statistics. And that was one of the major motivations to conduct this line of research.
So when we look at these disparities, I know this is a really loaded question, but what are some of the things that factor into that big divide?
Mm-hmm. So I am going to really give one example that my recent project, and this project is to focus on young African-American breast cancer survivors. I think there are statistics to support that young African-American women under the age of 35, they have breast cancer rates that are 2 times higher than the white woman of the same age. And also, the young African-American woman, when I say a young African-American woman, I refer to those who are aged younger than 45, and they have 3 times as likely to die from breast cancer as a white woman of the same age. A lot of people are still studying the reason why, the statistics is so alarming. I think probably a lot of these women are diagnosed with tumor that are more advanced, and they're also more likely to have the triple negative breast cancer, which has the very, worst outcome of all types, subtypes.
Yeah.
And also a lot of women in our communities, especially racial minority women, young women, they are afraid to talk about their breast. In conversation with racial minority women, when they talk about breast cancer, oftentimes they see that as a death sentence, so they do not want to talk about it. The less you talk about it, you are less likely to really seek the diagnosis and have the timely treatment.
So you said women under 45, African-American women under 45 have two times the rate of breast cancer than their white counterparts. Are there any genetic links? It's something that I think we often talk about, especially in my family having two breast cancer survivors. We talk about BRCA2, BRCA1. Are there higher rates of these kind of genetic mutations?
Yes, they are. Oftentimes, these women, like the patient that I talked to, they have a family histories of their grandmother, their mothers and sisters and siblings. They were diagnosed with breast cancer or ovarian cancer at age of younger than 45. So they have a family history oftentimes.
So you have this current project. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So the current project, we call it a patient-centered research because instead of looking at the statistics, we already knew all these statistics, we wanted to establish partnership teams between the patient who are African-American young breast cancer survivors under the age of 45 and their family members and caregivers and also the providers, healthcare providers. Those are the medical oncologist or medical college of Wisconsin, as well as researchers. So we work together to working with the patient to identify questions that are most relevant to patient through a series of conversation and also an interactive storytelling event. So this is a one-year project. So at the end, we will engage patient to share their personal stories that are most relevant to themselves about their breast cancer diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship. And we hope at the end that there would be something coming up for the researchers to really focus on as a follow-up. So this is my, project is about.
So you're in the middle of this research right now, but what are the kinds of questions that you're already seeing emerge from the women you're working with?
I would say these questions were related to a series of stage of cancer continuums from early detections of cancer and then from the diagnosis and the treatment to survivorship. So in terms of breast cancer, it's not a separate stage of, the cancer itself. It has a continuum of, I would say it's a journey a woman has gone through from diagnosis to treatment and to the survivorship. So at this time, we do not know exactly the answer of, what they're most interested. But we hope to get the answer by the end of this one-year project. And our hypothesis, as most of the researchers think, it has a lot to do with some of the social factors, like the neighborhood where they live in, and also the high rates of obesities and their family histories. Some of the gene mutations, the genes they carry in their family history, and also their access to care, the quality of care, and probably also contribute to their late diagnosis.
As someone who has gone along with my sister, who currently has breast cancer, one of the things that they ask you at the beginning of almost all of these appointments...
Family history,
and are you Ashkenazi Jewish? Are you Jewish is one of the big questions. And we found out very quickly that the reason was that if you are Ashkenazi specifically, you have a much higher chance of getting cancer. And I'm sure that is the result of a lot of studies that showed us if you are Ashkenazi, you have a higher chance of getting cancer. Have we had analogous studies with the African-American community to see if there is this much greater chance of getting breast cancer?
As far as I know, there are at least one or two very large-scale genetic study going on funded by the National Cancer Institute. They're trying to look at the interrelationship between environmental factors and their genetic factors and how those factors contribute to their poor survival rate of breast cancer. Yes, there is study, but not enough. I think we should have more studies going on to really trying to find out you know, the relationship.
One of the parts of your, one of the elements of your study is exercise. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So exercise has a numerous biological effect on the body, on our body, and some of which has been proposed to explain the association with specific cancers, like breast cancer that we're talking about. So exercise will have the abilities to lower the level of hormones such as insulin and estrogen, and also of certain growth factors that have been associated with cancer development and progressions. And also, exercise helps to prevent obesity. As we know that obesity is associated with breast cancer, exercise can reduce inflammations and it improves the immune system functions of people. So exercise has a lot of benefits for people who are overweight or not overweight. And so one of my studies is to look at how exercise could benefit the quality of life for African-American breast cancer survivors. The study currently is ongoing, and we were doing the variety of exercise that are culturally relevant to those African-American women. For example, in the format of Zumba and line dance, and we are doing that in the Kin Center, community centers located on the Valit Street. So it is community-based, and a lot of participants really like this format of exercising because it's a group-based exercise, and most of the participants are African-American breast cancer survivors themselves, so they like to socialize with each other, and they like to come to the community centers that is located within their neighborhood, and they enjoy laughters and happiness, and, you know, within themselves.
So you have both of these studies going on right now.
Yeah.
They both deal with this kind of disparity in health outcomes. Where do they meet? How do they interact with one another, these two studies?
So the first study is funded by the American Cancer Society. And the first study was particularly focused on promoting physical activity or exercise among African-American breast cancer survivors. While we're doing these studies, I noticed that a good portion of survivors, they were younger African-American women, and they told me about their personal stories of their young, you know, their family diagnosis, family history of breast cancer. They were diagnosed in their middle 30s or early 40s. So I really see this emerging need to look at the subgroups of this woman. And a lot of them, they are also suffered by severe factors, psychological distress and unemployment and fertilities, and also the early menopause due to their treatment. So I think these are the needs that the older breast cancer survivors or women, they have, we don't address these needs of younger women. So I wrote a proposal, and this second study was funded by the PCORI, the Patient Center Outcome Research Institute, and this study is particularly, the second study is particularly focused on younger African-American breast cancer survivor under the age of 45, particularly to address their need that are underrepresented or understudied by the general public or the general scientific world.
When do you expect to wrap up both of these?
So the first study is promoting exercise is about to finish. We're currently conducting the trials. So we're hoping to finish the trial by the end of this year. And then, of course, some disseminations. So by next year, I think the exercise study is about to finish. I hope to, you know, update some progress. And the second study for young breast cancer survivors is actually just got funded, and we're planning to recruit the patient in 2018.
Great. Well, Alice, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, thank you very much.
Dr. Alice Yan is a professor at the Joseph Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and there is more about her research at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us. I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.